This is Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, a podcast series designed to help medical students and residents strategically navigate the process of applying for residency in emergency medicine or to EM-sponsored fellowship programs. I'm your host, Mike Gisanti from Stanford University. Let's get started.
Welcome to Emergency Medicine Match Advice, our Google Hangout web series sponsored by the wonderful website, Academic Life in Emergency Medicine, and its editor-in-chief, a medical educator known literally around the world, and you can tell by the number of Twitter followers she has, Dr. Michelle Lin from UCSF. Hi, Michelle. How are you today?
Good. Hello, world. Thanks for the intro. I'm looking forward to the chat today.
So am I. We have got a great one for you today. The title alone is getting me excited about the discussion, Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Am I Competitive? And to help us answer that question, we've got some wonderful PDs with us today, Dr. Madonna Fernandez from Harbor UCLA and Dr. Kevin Beese from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So what does it mean to be competitive in the match? Like anything, you need to know what you're competing for. If you're competing for something, you need to know the process, the rules of the competition, the game, if you will. I think the match is very much a game of sorts, and you need to know who you're competing against. So, you know, it's my feeling that students need advisors who are willing and able to realistically assess their individual strengths relative to their peers. I think that this is a critically important step to answering the billion-dollar question, how many programs should I apply to? Right? That's the question that's on all the students' minds in August and September every year. How many programs should I apply to in order to, one, simply match, right? You want enough programs on your list such that you can pretty much guarantee that you're going to find a place somewhere. How many programs should I apply to see enough programs that you'll not only match, but hopefully find one or two or three or more that you really like and that you can put at the top of your own rank list to hopefully ensure that you're going to match someplace that you really want to be? And then how many programs should I apply to considering the cost? This process is extremely expensive for students. The more and more programs that you add, that cost is in and of itself quite concerning, but then you have to fly to all those places and stay at a hotel and rent a car, and hopefully they're going to give you a free lunch, but that's about the only free thing that's going to happen out on the trail. And I'll tell you from my own experience, this is a long time ago, I carried quite a bit of credit card debt incurred during my fourth year interview season, well into the second year of residency. And it was hard to get rid of that debt because it is an expensive process. So the old paradigm, I think, is that students knew emergency medicine was competitive, but perhaps they underestimated their ability to get into EM. They could be advised to apply and often would get a spot at their surprise. Now I think students may overestimate their ability. I think it's a little bit harder to get into than it once was. And it still sort of lives in that it's a competitive specialty, but just how competitive? First, I think we should look at the numbers. Michelle is going to bring up a file here entitled How Competitive is the EM Match?
I'm on it. I'm Miss AB Tech Day.
All right, excellent. So this was simply a summary of the most recent National Residency Matching Program, NRMP, results and data tables report that publishes the most recent stats on the match and then for the last several years. So I'm going to take you through this once it kind of appears on the screen again, Michelle. I'm going to take everyone through this file just to sort of get a sense of how competitive is it. We say it's competitive. How competitive is it? Column one are the years. The last 7 years worth of data for emergency medicine. Column two is the number of allopathic EM residency programs that participated in the match in those respective years. Column three is the corresponding number of entry-level positions that were available through the match in the allopathic EM program. Sometimes there are new programs that don't quite hit the deadlines right and they can fill a class outside of the match, but by and large, almost all of the spots every year really should be considered to be available only through the match. The fourth column is the number of those positions that were filled in the match overall. And importantly, the fifth column are the number of those positions that were filled by LCME US seniors. And those are folks who are fourth year medical students at medical centers, medical schools in the United States, Canada, and Puerto Rico. You have to be LCME accredited. Anyone who's not a U.S. senior at an LCME school, I'd say, or the non-U.S. LCME. The columns in red was chosen for a reason, are sort of important columns of numbers that help us understand just how competitive EM is. The first of the red columns gives us the percent fill rate by the LCME U.S. seniors. And I think that this is a good judge of how any specialty is. So the most competitive specialties tend to fill with a rate of 90% or greater by U.S. seniors. They don't tend to be any surprises. These tend to be radiation oncology, vascular surgery, plastic surgery. Emergency medicine has never had that fill rate. We've never filled 90% of our positions with U.S. seniors. We're generally, though, as you can see on this table, in the 70s and 80s. And I think in the next couple of years, we're going to approach 90% fill rate with LCME seniors. We are a competitive specialty, but perhaps not a highly competitive specialty in that way. The second red column shows the number of positions that are available in the SOAP, or what used to be known as the scramble. And even though you see numbers in that column, students, you should essentially assume that those are a bunch of zeros, right? Because when you see 12 or 15 spots open on SOAP day, I was going to call it scramble day, on SOAP day, that's less than 1% of the total number of positions available in the mat, essentially zero. In terms of strategy, none of you should be planning to scramble into emergency medicine in the end of the interview season. If I don't match into whatever, I'll get a position through the SOAP and EM. Like, that doesn't happen. One shouldn't use that as a backup plan. The third red column is the number of unmatched EM-bound LCME U.S. seniors. So this means fourth-year medical students at medical schools accredited by the LCME in the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico who only applied to emergency medicine. They were only EM-bound. They didn't put more than one application in. How many didn't match? Like, that's the scary number, right? And if you look at the last 7 years, it's always been under 100. Compare that number to the number of unmatched EM-bound non-U.S. seniors, so folks graduating from U.S. osteopathic medical schools or from international schools. That number hovers in the 100 to not quite 200. So about 300 people at most each year go unmatched. And hopefully from this series and some of the discussions that follow, we can help get you into that column of 1,700 who actually do match. Let me pause there and kind of get Michelle's input. What do you think about these numbers in general?
Well, thanks, Mike. I think so many things come through my head when I see this. I first saw you tweet this out, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, how great is this PDF? Thank you for making this. And then, bam, the colors hit me. And it's like a shock and all ugly colors. It's stressing me out just looking at the colors without even looking at the numbers. And it makes me start sweating. But if you really look at the numbers, it's much more reassuring than the numbers would imply. And like you said, the percent, so that first column of red, I think should make it blue in the future, by the way. It's much more soothing. But if you look at it, like you said, it's way under 9%, meaning that it's not a horribly competitive field. It's very doable. This whole form just points to the fact that this is a very doable field to go if you have a good advisor who has a pulse on the carotid of the EM landscape. For instance, your clerkship directors and residency director leadership, if they know kind of what's out there, you're going to be in good hands. These are very reassuring numbers. And if you look at, for instance, that third red column about number of EM-bound unmatched seniors, it's double digits. I mean, think about the number of people actually applying in the EM, the denominator, right? Because 44 initially, that first number sounds scary, but think about the denominator. In 2014, the denominator was like 1550, right? That's a huge number. And so with that in mind, I think you should kind of go about this with a realistic and hopefully more reassured stance as you go towards application season. And those are kind of my initial thoughts.
Michelle, this is Kevin. Just to kind of echo in on that, I agree. I look at those numbers and they tell me that if you're a U.S. allopathic medical student that's done well in school, there's a home for you in emergency medicine. Our job is to help you find that home. And if that's not, if you're not allopathic or not a U.S. student, there's still opportunities for you in emergency medicine, and you can work with the right advisors to help realize those.
Absolutely. I think really what we're getting at is the title of the talk, how competitive am I? And if you have an advisor who understands, as Michelle puts it, the landscape out there and has a sense of where the geographic areas are that perhaps dictate competitiveness alone for programs, you can best advise your students on how to create a strategy to be able to get themselves in the mix and compete for those spots. That's what really this discussion is all about.
There's a residency home for every applicant out there, every U.S. applicant out there, I think.
Right, and we can certainly look at the numbers and believe that, right? It's not quite a one-to-one ratio, but as the number of EM programs grows every year and the number of positions increases even a little bit higher than just from the new programs, but because the current existing programs continue to expand, so does the interest of the general medical student population. And now we have more and more med schools coming online, so there'll be more fourth-year students out there. But at some point, one will outpace the other, and that one-to-one ratio may not always be there. But for this application season, I think we can anticipate that there's a spot for everyone. I'm going to give you a couple of articles that will be on the Academic Life website that you can check out that perhaps can help a little bit as you're thinking about the question, am I an average applicant? Am I a competitive, highly competitive applicant? The first article came out of Academic Emergency Medicine in January 2000. I want to point out I was an intern in January 2000. It's entitled Selection Criteria for emergency medicine residency applicants. It was written by Joseph Crane and Carl Ferraro at University of Illinois Chicago, crosstown here at UIC. The reason I bring it up is it's one of the first articles ever written on this topic, and it gets cited because of that in many of the other articles. So if a student looks it up, looks this topic up, I should say, you may come across this article. Their most important criteria for selecting residency applicants at the time was your EM rotation grade on your fourth year clerkship, the score given to you in your interview, your third year clerkship grades, and then the overall recommendations made in the then SLOR, now SLO, the standardized letter of evaluation. The least important criteria for them included AOA membership, membership in Alpha, Omega Alpha, and research experience. And I would argue that if you think about this, this is selecting applicants probably on the rank list portion of what PDs are doing, not necessarily selecting them for interview. My guess is if you're AOA, you're going to have a much easier chance of getting an interview. But just because you're AOA doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get ranked at the top of anyone's rank list should you show up and bomb the interview. And I think that's why the interview score probably is a more important marker. The second article, also from Academic Emergency Medicine, June 2001, also from some colleagues across town at Christ Medical Center, Dan Grisadas and Bob Harwood, entitled Emergency Medicine SLOR, Standardized Letter of Recommendation, Predictors of a Guaranteed Match. Now that sounds nice, right? Like, what are the predictors of a GM, a guaranteed match? I want to guarantee that I match. So let's get to the predictors. The predictors in this article through logistic regression were really two things. If on this we're just talking about standardized letter of recommendation. We're not talking about other parts of the application. But if on the standardized letter, you have the outstanding box or the highest checkbox for work ethic and for the global assessment question at the bottom, you are a guaranteed match. And they have an interesting, very profound statement in this article. They say resident selection is an inexact science. Resident selection is not an exact science. That is a true story. And that's a little bit why we're doing some of these sessions and trying to get people's opinions on this process. The last article we're going to talk about, and the one that I think is really going to kickstart our conversation, came out of the Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2008. It's entitled Becoming an Emergency Medicine Resident, A Practical Guide for Medical Students. And it was from the folks out of UC Irvine, Mark Landorf, Federico Vodka, and Sharam Olatapur, and then Steve Hayden from UCSD. It's a review article. It describes all the key parts of the ARIS application, and then it goes on to tell you to do well in each of these various areas. So at first glance, this would seem like a very frustrating article for a fourth-year medical student to read, right? It just lists all the parts and says, do well, right? You should get great step one scores and great grades and have great extracurriculars. And after a while, that's got to be very frustrating. But if you sit with the overall message and you put it in context with a lot of the other articles that we've cited on our series so far, there is an overarching theme, and that theme is achievement, right? And that's what we're going to try to get our head around in this discussion. What does it mean to be average in medical school? The average medical student is an incredibly talented person that got themselves into med school and did really well. They just might happen to be in the middle of their class. That's still quite competitive for EM, and that's a different moniker, if you will. But am I average? Am I above average? Am I below average? Someone needs to help advise you and give you context for that, and that's going to be the folks in EM that are skilled at advising students. The theme of these articles is do well in everything. It's pretty good advice, but now let's try to get to some numbers, right? Like, what does it mean to do well in step one, and what does it mean to do well in your clerkship? That's what I'd like our panelists to address. So I'm going to welcome one more panelist who had a little bit of technical difficulty joining our hangout at the beginning, but he's here, and welcome Dr. Andrew Perrin from Maine Medical Center. Hmm. Andy, can you hear me? All right, well, let's throw his first question. I was going to give him to you, Michelle. You advise students all the time. You are the queen bee, as I put it. How do you advise them regarding the number of applications that they should put out or perhaps the goal number of interviews that they should be shooting for?
Oh, isn't that the million-dollar question? Back when we were applying, we were just told to apply to three because that's how many programs were out there, right? So now there's like 170 of them. How many? Do you apply to all 170? Do you apply to just three? And the answer is somewhere in between that, obviously. So my general approach, and I'm curious to hear what you guys also, what your recommendations are, but I try to aim for about, not the 1 percentile of the class, but I'm aiming to advise the 75th percentile of the class, right? So with that, I say, given the slightly more competitive nature of the field over these past 8 or 9 years you showed, I do recommend about applying to 30 to start, right? Just kind of the paper application, get it out there. And then I grab their entire application bundle. I look at, and like you mentioned, their grades during for the EM rotation, their third year grades, their USMLE scores. I bundle it all together. I put it in my little magic eight ball, I shake it up, or maybe more like a crystal ball, I shake it up, and then numbers start appearing, like -5. And I go, well, maybe you should apply to 25 because you have some pretty good stuff. Or they are an Olympian. Okay, -8. And I start whittling down to, and the number usually ends up being around 18 to 25 for the most part, but I give them a round number of 30 to start with. And then they're really challenged. I maybe ask them to apply to more than 30 and then have that honest talk about really if EM might be for them. Because I think you have to be honest when you're trying to advise these students. That's my 2 cents.
I think I can weigh in.
Oh, all right. No. Welcome, Dr. Parrott.
Yay.
I'm tired of dominating this conversation, and I'm going to have to quiet down for a while. Can I just add? So first of all, I apologize. Second of all, Michelle is, on the number of applications, I think Michelle's exactly right.
But
I think more important than what she said is that you need to find your Michelle to give you a good idea. That's, I think, the worst advising. The worst advising I see is people who work at, who don't have much experience giving advice. And I see students who have gotten really odd advice. And I say, first of all, you need to find an advisor like Michelle who will tell you how you are, whether you're in that apply to less than 20 or greater than 30 group. But I think she has the number right. I think Michelle's right in that it's going to start out somewhere around 30. You're going to wind up interviewing obviously less places. But first, you need to find somebody who can assess you and tell you how competitive you are.
Absolutely. And let's stick with you for a moment here, Andy, while we've got you. I think that's a great starting number. Is it tailored at all? Michelle's talking about her Olympians at UCSF and how she lets them apply to 8 less programs. Do you tailor from 30 or do you just pretty much help them select 30 perhaps appropriate programs rather than apply to X or apply to less?
So I think in the situation, so that every year I always tell applicants this, there's a big chunk of applicants and there's a small percentage, maybe 10%, who we all know they can go where they want and do what they want. And I think if they've got a really strong idea of where they want to go, they should apply to a smaller number of programs and go, I can look at an application. And we all know who those superstars are. My APD interviewed at 3 programs and applied to and ranked 1, which gave me a heart attack when she matched here, because what if it hadn't worked out? But she knew she was going to go where she wanted to. I would never recommend that few number. But I think you can look at somebody, and I can tell, I can definitely see applicants as they come through, and I just tell them, you're going to get to choose where you want to go. Be really careful. You know, make sure you think about where you want to put number 1 on your list, because that's where you're going. Who those people are. They can apply to any number they want. There is also the person on the other end who they've got a long shot at making it an EM, and they need to do a whole bunch. I think for that, it's the 75% in the middle. I think for most of them, that number around 30 is good. And that's going to be, and just to define my terms, the superstar has never done anything wrong. They killed the boards. They've got honors in every clinical rotation they've ever been on. They have 2 program director letters that say they walk on water, and they were the captain of Notre Dame football. No offense. But I was trying to pick
Notre Dame October 4th. We'll see.
I was trying to pick a Midwest strong football team. So that person, we all agree. They're going to do
Northwestern? Come on.
It was not.
Now you got me all riled up. All right. So I'm going to interrupt and ask you to clarify, though. So you were saying 30 applications is a good number, but you're putting out applications in order to get X number of interviews, right? So we tell them to apply to 30. Do we actually mean interview at 30? What's the right number to interview at?
That would be crazy.
If you're applying to 30 and getting an interview at every one of the programs to which you applied, then you're definitely interviewing too much. And I think that does a disservice to the lower half of the students in medical school classes. If you're recommending that the top half of a strong medical school applies to 30 programs, and then they schedule all those interviews, they're really taking a spot from the lower half of those solid medical students that could interview at that program and potentially match there. What I also advise, particularly the stronger students, is once they start getting their interviews, if they're getting asked to interview at a majority of programs, to start canceling where they really would not like to go, so that they are opening a spot for someone else.
Absolutely, Madonna, but always with 2 weeks' notice, wouldn't you say? I strongly agree with you. And tactically, what do you do with your medical students? So you listen to your program director and your assistant dean who lives for the goal of making sure everyone in her medical student class graduates. Mm-hmm. So they're going to tell you to apply to a lot of places. And you may start getting interview applications or letters, sorry, from places where you're less excited, wherever that is for you earlier on. Tactically, you put those a little later in the interview season so you can always cancel them with 2 weeks advance notice. You want to interview at 10 to 15 places. The one exception to that may be couples matching. God bless you. But there are tactics.
Relationships are ending all over the country right now.
Sorry about that.
Turned to their seat and they said, I told you so.
Yeah. No. But besides that, if you're not couples matching, I can't imagine interviewing at more than 15. I can imagine a whole lot of people getting more than 15 letters. You schedule them later, you cancel them with 2 weeks notice. It is always the right thing to do. I will always support that decision because you're opening up that spot for someone who really does want to come to that particular program. It's the right thing to do.
Andy, so certainly arguing in favor of finding an appropriate advisor and sort of tailoring this number 30 one way or the other, what do you think about minimum number of interviews? Even for the walk-on-water candidate that you talked about, I would say your APD, that would have stressed me out if they were my advisee and only interviewing at three places. What's the minimum number no matter what?
Yeah, it's going to be, you owe it to yourself if you are that person. You owe it to yourself to go look and see what programs, because I always tell them there's nothing about med school that particularly makes you smart about choosing a residency. You have to do the homework. And so you need to go and see what's out there. You've done all this work. Your resume is never going to be stronger than it is right then. So go and, you know, maybe 8 or 10 places. If you're that superstar, you're going to get one of your top three choices almost certainly. But go see what's out there, because you don't start the process the same person you are when you finish the process. And I always tell applicants, the second half of interview season for me much more interesting, because we have much better conversations than how many chest tubes do you do and how many central lines you do. And it's much more about, tell me about the program. What's the feeling of this program? Who succeeds here? But you get much better questions because you've had some experience and you now know what else is out there. So I think, and for that person, I'd say if you have the money, interview 8 or 10, but I don't think you need to do any more than that. And if you've got it figured out after 5 or 6, I'm okay stopping there too, because you're going to go somewhere in your top three if you're that superstar candidate.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that just the nature of the variability amongst emergency medicine programs, there's 3 years and 4 years, and there's university-based and community-based and county-based programs, or some military programs that accept civilians. There's so much variety. Even just to get a sense of that, you're probably going to need to sample a couple from each type, and that's getting you up towards 8, 10, 12 interviews, just to get an understanding of what's out there.
I think that's true, and we advise a lot of the University of Vermont and the Tufts students, and the cost is not insignificant for traveling 10, 12, 14, 16 places. I don't remember how I afforded it, but I don't think it was as bad back then as it is now. You can drop a small fortune. If you're going to interview a lot of places and you're flying, you're dropping a small fortune on that travel. That's for sure.
Well, one of the things I also recommend to the applicants who are spending that small fortune on traveling is that job seeking expenses are tax deductible if they're within the fiscal year. And so paying for those after January 1st allows them to deduct it from their taxes when they're finally actually going to pay them on that fabulous resident salary they're going to make.
Madonna, I wish you were around in 1998 to have told me that, because I certainly didn't deduct them from my taxes. That would have been. Dr. Bice.
Sure.
Let's switch gears a little bit, and I'd like some insider secrets about how you screen applications. What's the process? Students are told to send 30 out, and they've met with their advisor who told them that they aren't competitive, and to worry or not worry. Then what happened? They hit a button on ARIS. Tell us what happens after that.
Right. So they file in. The applications file in, and we hear how many come in, so the total adds up. I personally don't start reading them. I read them all at once, and I read them after the dean's letter comes out. So the dean's letter comes out October 1st now, and personally, I want the whole packet. We get over 1,000 applications every year, as I bet you the other folks on this line do, and I'm not looking through the first round and the second round and all that. I read them all after the dean's letter comes out, so I have a chance to read the whole thing. The most important thing about screening is, for me, is to understand that the metrics that we assess medical students on are far from valid, right? For those of you who are college basketball fans, it would be like Roy Williams here at UNC picking his basketball team based on how well they memorize the playbook. It's not actually what he's interested in. I want to know how good of a doctor you are, not how good of a test taker you are. And there are some things that get closer to that. Your clerkship's grades in the third year. And I really like the dean's letters that kind of tell me, this is how good you did on rotation, and this is how your test score was. But if not, I can still figure it out. Your slow letters, the secret language that's within them that tells me how you did in the emergency department more than how you did on the test at the end of the rotation. Those things are really important. Other things about you, right? Try to take a holistic view. I'm looking for some hint of your your background, where you came from, what you overcame. If you are a successful waiter, that is fantastic. You have half the necessary skills to be an amazing emergency medicine physician, if not more. So I'm trying to get a sense of all those things, because the things that we usually turn to, your step one scores. I would like you to do well. What I mean by do well, I'm more comfortable if there's a 2 at the beginning of that number. But whether it's a 240 or a 230, I've never seen a study that would suggest that there's, I don't think that means anything about your level of success in emergency medicine. So what am I doing? I'm taking this huge pile and I'm trying to make it small. I actually divide the pile up amongst my different program directors, and we look at applications within piles from the same school, because the schools have certain letters that I can understand the patterns of what's coming out of there. And I give them the right to each pick a few hundred applications to look at, and then each select from that 20 or so they're going to interview, and 10 on the backup list. And we do go to our backup list every year, because people, not everybody shocks me every time it doesn't happen, but some people choose not to interview with us. It's astounding. And so it opens up those spots, like Madonna was saying. So I don't use hard score cutoffs, again, because I don't think it's a valid marker. I want to know how well you play the sport. I want to know how well you're going to take care of patients. I want to know that you're going to show up 5 minutes early for a shift. I want to know that when the going gets tough, you're going to stick it out and do a great job of caring for your classmates and your patients, more than I want to know whether you got a 240 or a 230 on those boards. Holistic view, whittle it down, and hope we pick the right ones, knowing in all sincerity that there are a whole bunch of great applicants out there that we just can't interview.
That's great. That's really a great insight, I think, for the students. I would say that we do a very similar process at Northwestern. We wait for the dean's letter. I think the more experienced I get in this role, the more and more I appreciate elements of the dean's letter. And I think a lot of studies out there suggest it's not the first thing that the PDs go to, but I actually really like it. And I agree with you. I don't look at anything that arrives before the dean's letter. There's got to be some baseline cutoffs. I would like to see a 2 comment is very interesting to me. You know, the USMLE is a criterion referenced exam, right? It's really meant to select out, are you minimally competent or not? So that's the pass-fail line. And it's not meant to be used to compare students, though we do it all the time. This is the same sort of phenomenon with the SAT in many ways. So to be a truly impressive score, you need to beat the mean by a standard deviation. And if the mean, I think, for this upcoming class is 226 or 227, and the standard deviation is 16 or 17, we're talking high 240s is true achievement. And, you know, I like to see a 23 something or a 24 something, but is that really different than the 225? Statistically speaking, it's not. And if you start to think about those things, you can really define what is true achievement. Someone who gets a 265 and beats it by 2 standard deviations, that's impressive. You got to kind of step back and look at it. But that's certainly a very small and narrow portion of the applicant pool.
It is absolutely impressive, but it is one data point of impressiveness.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure it's more impressive than being the captain of your college soccer team or the real work you did in sub-Saharan Africa for a year and a half. Not the medical tourism for 2 weeks, although that's cool and you learned a lot from it. But I mean, I'm just looking at it is an impressive data point, but it is a data point telling me that you have real skills and more importantly, you committed yourself to something and followed through and achieved on a level that I anticipate you replicating while you're taking care of patients and working in my program. But that can be shown in many different facets of excellence. And my hope is to be able to get a sense of where do you excel and how does that predict the future?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And for the students out there who have a 220 USMLE Step 1, if you were waiter of the year, then you should be applying to Chapel Hill. And I think that's a great takeaway. So that's takeaway point number one for today. But before we move to some questions I have for Madonna, I do want to know, Kevin, the student who perhaps doesn't have all these great numbers that we were just talking about, let's say they have very average to a little bit lower step scores, they're in the bottom quartiles of their class. They really don't have any honors. How do you advise them? Do you just tell them to click more and more and more boxes on the ARIS application and apply to tons more programs? Or should they be thinking about, well, what programs perhaps would allow me a competitive advantage if I applied there versus there?
I think that's a really good question. 2 comments on that. One is some students have specific stumbling blocks, or many students that fall into that category have specific stumbling blocks. Perhaps most commonly, not awesome standardized test takers. So step one really was a struggle. And they do well clinically, but they always mess up the shelf exam compared to how they'd like to do and certainly compared to how they feel and then how they might know the knowledge. So my comment on that is you put in the very middle of your personal statement, you put a short paragraph about, hey, you look at my application, I'm not a great test taker. That's no secret. Your application presented me with a question. Geez, you're not a great test taker. Wonder why that is. I want the answer in your personal statement. And actually, I don't want to know why you're not a great test taker. I want to know what you've learned from those struggles and how it is that you're going to use that moving forward. You look at my application. I'm not a great test taker. This is what I've learned. And what I know about myself is I've got to study hard throughout all of residency. These are the tactics that I take, and this is why I know I'm going to do well moving forward. Your personal statement's a whole page. This is a paragraph. You're a lot more than that one stumbling block, but address, answer the question that comes up when you look at it. How do you pick where to apply? So that same student is not going to get interviews at some other places that they might have gotten interviews, right? Some of that, frankly, is random. We're lucky to be pretty competitive, as is everyone on this call, but our board scores are pretty varied because it's not the only thing we look at. So you might get interviews at some place you don't expect. So don't necessarily knock off all the bigger names schools. But what I advise them to do to pick safe day schools is pick the geographical regions they're most excited about and blow those out. So let's say you're looking at Chicago and you've got a couple favorite schools in that area. But then you should also apply to Northwestern or apply to the other schools on that list too.
Wow. Jeez, first football and now Yam. Yes. They're kicking us around.
And just blow out the region. And that way you're picking your favorite areas and you're going to expand your horizon a little bit more than if you were that superstar student Michelle was talking about earlier. And your list just went from 30 to 50 by taking those three or four geographical regions you're interested in blowing it out. One more comment. We looked at that table you gave at the beginning of this. I do believe that for good medical students graduating from U.S. medical schools, there is a home for you in emergency medicine. Even for good medical students that slipped up. But what you can't do is say, okay, school hasn't come super easily to me. There are some deficits in my application, but I'm only looking at one city. That's it. I'm going to San Francisco. That's a luxury that you can't afford yourself. So, you know, if you are going to struggle a little bit getting in, you got to apply broadly. Otherwise, you really do run a serious risk of not matching.
I agree. And I think your point about addressing whatever red flags or in your application and addressing them directly is a really important point. I may have shared on another one of these web series that I don't really read personal statements all that consistently. So I would also suggest another place to perhaps have that red flag addressed is with a thoughtful discussion with a known advisor who may be one of your letter writers could also comment on your behalf in a manner.
Mike, God bless you for the personal statement thing. I thought I was the only one who ignored those mostly. What I think what Kevin said is really important is that if you have weakness in your application, that is your one shot at giving me the reason why you have weakness in your application. And that's the one I go to and I look. If you have a gap, if you have bad scores, if you have a rotation that went terribly, if you don't address it in your personal statement, the only time I gave you to address it was there. And if you don't address it, I'm moving on. So I agree. I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Madonna.
I agree. That the only time I do look at the personal statement is if I do see an overall pretty strong file and then there's one discrepancy. I want to know what happened. And it might be something, you know, a death in the family. It might be just no explanation at all, but I want to see that particular weakness addressed. Otherwise, it's going to come up in every interview.
Well, one other comment on the personal statement. Sorry, Mike, real quick.
Get an interview at all.
Yes, exactly, if you get an interview. On the personal statement, I do read them. I think they are more likely to hurt you than help you. Just a couple comments on that. You asked how I screen. Not so smart personal statements screen you out. I once read one that said that this person was looking up at the stars. I'm going to try and be a little vague here in case they're watching this.
No,
and
tell the story.
Reapplying.
They're not watching.
He was lying in a raft. It was the opening sentence. He said he was lying in a raft and he was looking up at the stars and they assembled the stethoscope in the sky. And that's why he knew he was called to be a doctor, okay? And I thought you shouldn't share about your acid trips in your application. That's not cool. And so most of us are not Maya Angelou, T.S. Eliot, John Keats, whoever these people are, we're not them, most of them. A couple of you are. By all means, lay it on. I love it. But the other 99.9% of you are not. Be straightforward. Be factual. Be sincere. But don't be ridiculous. Also, proofread those babies. If it goes out to the committee, right, I can't proofread to save my life. So get someone else to proofread them. But someone's going to be nitpicky and say, that should have been a semicolon. If this person doesn't pay attention to this part of their application, what does that say about when they're writing orders on a patient? It will hurt you if you're silly or just ridiculous about your personal statement, if you overreach, and it will hurt you if you don't proofread it really well.
Well, I absolutely agree. And Andy, you're not the only one that skims through, let's call it that, the personal statements. I'll say this, I don't know if any other advisors are going to end up watching this web series, but you can really help your student if you meet with them and they're an otherwise great candidate and they're perfect for our specialty and they perhaps had terrible gastroenteritis the night before step one, and you put in your slur narrative, please don't overlook this student, he is more than his step one score, and he addresses this in his personal statement. Call out the personal statement. I will then go to the personal statement and read it with great interest. I don't know if that's a valid suggestion or not.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's not that I never read them. I read them right before I meet you, so we have something to talk about. But I've looked for pathology when I've scanned the application.
We're going to switch to Madonna. We've talked a lot about getting great advice and that it's so important to figure out how competitive you are with respect to which programs perhaps are more competitive. Where do you get that advice? Where's the special advisor pulled up? How do you go find them?
Well, other than these fabulous posts by you and Michelle, most medical schools, the schools that have, there's sort of two categories here. There are the schools that have an EM affiliate, and it's, I think, much easier for the medical students to find advisors there. They usually, through the dean's office, have a program that will either refer you to potential advisors or just automatically pair you up. Interestingly, our institution recently disqualified the program directors from being advisors to those going into their specialty.
But where was that?
UCLA. Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently a conflict of interest. So my last advisee is currently in our intern class, but what the students really want in an advisor is someone who knows the process and is involved in the selection process of residents. So they know what the selection committee is looking for. And if it's not going to be a program director, it's a clerkship director, an associate or assistant program director at their institution, and not likely someone who's been working in the community or is not involved in any way in education or the selection process. The more difficult category is the students who are at schools that don't have an affiliated EM program, and there are online advisory services. Actually, SAEM has the e-advisor program, and I believe Michelle is an advisor on that. I don't think the rest of us are, but I'm about to be shamed into maybe putting myself on there since I can't advise the students at UCLA anymore.
Do it, do it.
But that is actually a very useful resource, and it has the allopathic, it has a couple osteopathic advisors, and it allows access to advisors for students who might not otherwise have them. Particularly, I think the osteopathic and even international medical students can go to that resource and get electronic advising from people who are experienced in the process.
Yeah, it's a wonderful service. I'll tell you that I graduated from Loyola. They didn't have an EM program. They still don't have an EM program, and it's difficult for students from schools like that. I had a hard time, and really, in many ways, needed my way rotation just to validate the information that I was getting at my home rotation. I'll say this, so not to pick on UCLA's decision, but you're the one that makes...
Please do. I think it was horrible.
Outstanding. This is exactly what I wanted on this web series. So here's my question, though, for you, UCLA Dean. Madonna's the one that's making the decisions, and I get that there's a conflict of interest. My guess is there's a huge panel of folks on their selection committee that are fantastic faculty, because I know many of them personally. But she's the one that's the most experienced at evaluating the actual ARIS application. So who then should be the advisor? People that aren't reading the applications? Because that's where the speculation starts coming. You're going to get in. You'll get into that program. No problem. Then that personal statement. Kevin's going to love it. What defines a quality advisor? I guess that's really the question.
Well, I think a quality advisor is, as I mentioned, someone who knows the process, but it's also going to be someone that is honest with the student. Your advisor needs to be someone that will explain to you your likelihood of getting into a given program and can assess your competitiveness relative to all the other applicants. So it really is going to be someone who has seen multiple years of the applicant pool in emergency medicine, and also seeing where those applicants match the likelihood of getting in. I think honesty is really the key. If, you know, I do understand the conflict of interest. If I have an advisee that I really like, I obviously have a lot of pull in the selection committee. I get the final choice and the match list. But at the same time, I'm also someone who, as an advisor, I'm not looking out for my best interest all the time. We've got 1,000 applicants. There are a lot of excellent applicants. I don't want someone in my program that doesn't want to be here. My goal is to take the advisee to the place they want to be. And I've said this to my advisees along the way, is don't tell me you want to be here. I don't want to hear that. Tell me where you want to be. And if that's Northwestern, that's great. I can help you get there. That's really what you want in an advisor, is someone who will look out for your best interests, not their program's best interests.
I strongly agree with that. I tell all my students that come through here that meet with me, which is basically all of them, that starting from now, you're my student. And I'm not going to personally let impact at all where I put you on this rank list, where you tell me you want to go, or you got to lie to me, right? So if you really want to go to California or some crazy place, far off place like that, that's great, but you've got to be able to tell me that so I can call up Madonna and say this person's fantastic or have these conversations or like get that word out. And I realize that in 3 months you might decide you really need to be back in North Carolina near your home. So I tell them straight up, where you tell me about where you want to go has no impact on where I'm going to put you on this race list. And I've actually advocated strongly for my favorite students to go somewhere else, believing them at the very top of my rank list, knowing they weren't coming, but who cares? We're going to fill. We've got plenty of applications. This isn't about me, and it's not about Madonna. It's not about Andy. It's about the students getting where they want to go. One other comment on this question. It is really helpful to intersect with the program director, and I don't know if you're not allowed to speak to them anymore, Madonna. That would be a shame.
I do speak to them.
I give them all a big talk when they're rotating with us. I just grab them for an hour, go get a coffee, give them the spiel, so I can answer 90% of their questions kind of all at the same time. And then I invite them to come by the evening or send me an email, give me their quick credentials, and I'll give them some tailored advice. Usually I'm just echoing what our great advisors have said. I don't serve as individual advisor anymore because they were kind of jockeying to get that, right? And so I don't do that. But I just say, I weigh in on what's been, you know, yeah, okay, so-and-so said to apply to 30 programs. That makes sense, and that lines up. Or, you know what, I would add, or you're fine, or let me help you deal with a specific situation. So they have other advisors that know the gig, but they just run it by me real quick to make sure that it resonates with what I think is going on, because this is what we do all the time. We know how this is going to play out for them most of the time, and I think our input is really valuable. And getting to intersect with the program director across is probably priceless, not to overestimate my own work.
Just, panelists, we're getting a little bit of feedback on your microphone, so perhaps hit mute if you're not speaking at that moment. So, Madonna, I'm going to switch the question around, and I'm going to ask your thoughts on what questionable sources of advisors are out there, sources of advice or questionable advisors are out there for students. And I'm going to do a really well-intentioned one. So I bet there's a lot of residents that are going to watch this, and I think residents are great sources of information for students about where they just applied, right? They were the ones most recently at X program, and they know what they gave for lunch that day or what the trinket was or whatever, and they can answer those sorts of questions. But they're probably one of the worst groups of offenders in terms of assessing competitiveness, right? They don't want to offend the students. They're going to tell them, you're going to do great, when that might not be the truth. So what are some other questionable sources of advice?
Well, I found one of the most questionable sources of advice is the blogs that either the residents or students put up. And I think this is created on the interview trail because they experience one day, and granted your interview day is, as a program, your chance to shine, to show yourself, but it really doesn't represent the entire program. And I wasn't talking about your blogs, Michelle. Yours are fabulous. But I'm speaking about...
We'll go with unnamed blog.
Unnamed blogs. The students who are applying to the programs, speaking to each other, I think are not a reliable source of advice to give each other. And I see a lot of them give advice like, you should ask about your ability to moonlight during residency. Now, when someone asks me that, I know they're not really interested in the educational value of the program. They're interested in how much extra money they can make. That's a question they maybe would ask the residents when they're here, not a question that should take up their interview time with the program director or with the other faculty members. So that's just some of the advice that I've seen on those, on the blogs that the students have put up. I also think the advice that I've seen from, and after I criticize UCLA, I hope I have my job tomorrow, but when the dean is giving advice across the board to all medical students applying to different specialties, I think that is also a problem. Each, as we know, each specialty values different components of the medical student's application. For the dean to pan-advise all of the students to apply to 30 programs without considering the competitiveness of the program or what each individual program is going to value differently, I think that's a problem. And so the dean's, in my opinion, the dean's responsibility should be to refer those students to their specialty advisors.
Well, absolutely. I, too, don't want you to lose your job. So UCLA dean, Madonna's amazing, and your students are lucky to have her. That's my PSA. I will say, though, that the deans do just what you said at Northwestern, and they refer to Amy Kontrick, our clerkship director, and I, and I very much appreciate that, because if they didn't, they're sort of like their drunk doctor uncle, right? You know, drunk uncle? Like, let's make them drunk doctor uncle who happens to be an orthopedic surgeon who thinks perhaps he knows what the emergency medicine match is like. Certainly that drunk uncle doesn't know, and that would be a bad source of information, and you can insert anybody anybody into that category. And if they're not actively screening EM applications, I question if they really know how to properly advise the student. So I appreciate that. We're going to switch to Michelle. I want to hear your thoughts on where the discussion has gone so far.
Well, I apologize for muting Madonna. I think that was, you've been voted off the island. Oh,
I did not vote in echo.
Oh, you unmuted yourself. Oh, it's on. Okay, so my general thoughts, I think honing everything together, I think the bottom line can best be summarized as get a good advisor. I think that really boils down to it because there's so many things in play. There are no formulas out there that are going to exist besides my magic crystal ball, but there's nothing out there that exists to help you in this ever-shifting landscape. The e-advisor is a great system. Please do sign up. Don't everybody sign up for me. I'm going to sign up to Sandy and then you sign up for him. What
I
else?
I don't respond to email quickly that they're going to be in trouble.
I will give you his personal cell phone on the website. You could just call him up. But I think it's important to kind of understand who your champions are going to be, get some good advice. And with that, things are going to be fine. I know everyone's stress level goes higher and higher as it gets closer and closer to interview time. It's okay. If us five made it in, you're going to be fine. Get a good advisor.
Can I make one comment on Absolutely. In addition to that? Is there are two different games going on here. There is the get the interview game, and there is the go on the interview game. And especially for those wonderful students that some part didn't go well. You know, they're worried because their board scores weren't exactly what they wanted them to be, or they lost a loved one halfway through medical school and took 6 months off, or whatever it is. When you get an interview at the place, you are a valid academic candidate for that institution. So do not walk in there like, I'm so sorry, I didn't get a 270 on the boards. I know, I tried so hard. Don't do that. You're there because Mike, myself, Andrew, whoever, you are a valid candidate for that program. And so you walk in there, certainly not with hubris, but with gratitude, but joy and confidence that you are as eligible to be there as anyone else at that table. So you've got to apply to a bunch of places to get the interviews. Once you got the interviews, you're in the game and carry it forward and share with those places who you are. At that point, it's about finding the right place for you. And so you really kind of want to figure out whether that's the right place for you as much as you let them figure out whether you're the right person for them. Carry your head high. You've done fantastically. You're graduating from amazing institutions. You worked really hard to get there. For those of you who are in fourth year medical school, you're about to walk across that stage and be announced to your loved ones as Dr. So-and-so. That's huge. Celebrate that. You will land in a happy place. We look forward to meeting you.
I think that's a great summative comment, Kevin. And it's a great commercial for one of the next installments in our web series, Interviewing 101, coming to a website near you. Maybe we can start with you, Kevin. I just want to get 60-second wrap-up for pearls and pitfalls with respect to this competitiveness selecting program, getting an advisor. Quick pearl and pitfall for the students in a point of summary.
Run your list by a program director you have access to, even though they usually won't be your advisor, and make sure you apply to enough. It is expensive, but you don't have to interview at a bunch. You have to apply to a bunch. So when in doubt, check a few more boxes.
Okay. Andy.
So I love what I've heard. Just the follow-up to get a good advisor is be honest with them. Don't hide. If there's stuff that they need to know, you got to tell them. Give them permission to be honest with you. We did our focus of this residency 2 years ago was the year of feedback, where we talked a lot about feedback. How do you give it? But importantly, how do you get it? And you have to be, if I'm starting to tell you that you're not that great of a candidate and I get the lip quiver and the tear, I'm probably going to stop. And so you have to be an active listener and give your advisor permission to say, you're not that great of a candidate, or you got a 50-50 shot or whatever, and then do what they say. If you're going to go out of the way and you get a superstar like Michelle, do what she says, because there's a whole lot of experience that goes into the advice that she gave. I think that's get the advisor, but then don't stop there. Just keep going and do those things, because you're getting all the stuff you can't get from your peers and you can't get from a lot of the faculty at the program where you're at, and you probably can't get it from the dean, so make the best of what you got.
Yeah, absolutely. I wear the program director hat at Feinberg 2 days a year for my students, the day I interview them and the day I put them on my rank list. And otherwise, it's 363 days of faculty advisor. And, you know, I need you to be honest if you want me to help you. And hiding red flags in your file doesn't allow me to help you. So I think that's a great point. Madonna, what are your final sort of pearls and pitfalls? Oh, sorry, I think Michelle's got you muted. Start again for us.
I think one of the pitfalls people often fall into, and I've seen it happen a couple times, is that they limit themselves geographically to where they think they want to apply. Sometimes there are family and relationship issues that keep people in locations, but I encourage applicants to cast their net a little wider than they might think they want. They might not realize what a great place another part of the country might be to train. So don't limit yourself just based on geography. Check out a lot of different places.
Okay, great. I'm very grateful to all three of you for participating. I'll tell the audience, we had a lot of technical difficulties with this one today, and our folks were very patient. I'm grateful because it was a great discussion. I think there was lots to be learned. So as my thank you, I want to give you a second to plug your program here, and we're going to do it in the Tell Me Something I Don't Know game. So let's start with Andy. Tell me something I don't know about Maine Medical.
Maine Medical Center is a training program for 12 other departments. One of them is not named orthopedic surgery. And we like to think our orthopedic surgery experience here is unsurpassed. We have very supportive community orthopedists who are very comfortable with us managing orthopedic emergencies in the ED. I tell our interns they will do more prosthetic hip reductions in their first year than a lot of programs will do in their whole career or their whole training program. We do both bone forearm reductions. We use C-arm in the ED. If you want a great orthopedic experience, you may not know this, but Maine Medical Center, in the winter, there's a lot of falling down around here. We fix a lot of broken bones, and we do it ourselves with the support of our community orthopedists.
That's great. You know, I thought you were going to go with lobster traps. I know that the vast majority of your residents have their own lobster traps, and you know, the lore is they go out and get their lobsters out of the trap on the way to work and cook them that night. I imagine Maine to be this completely happy place in and of itself just because of the lobsters. So,
That it is. It is the happiest place on earth, and every resident can drop 12 lobster pots for free.
There you go. Students, you definitely have to check out Maine. Andy is such a nice guy, so knowledgeable, and every bit of feedback I've heard about interviewing there has been positive. Kevin, tell me something I don't know about the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Two things. One is we get to rotate in a standalone ED, which is fantastic. So, of course, UNC is a huge academic medical center, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But getting to work in a place where there ain't no consultants to call is invaluable, and I'm grateful that our residents have that opportunity. They do it on the weekends, their second and third year. The other comment is I was surprised that Harvard recently identified itself as the University of North Carolina of the North. I was shocked by that evolution, but it resonates with the academic prowess we've established.
You meant the Stanford of the North or the Northwestern or the South. Out there. Yeah.
What?
I get it. Yeah.
Oh, that's way out there in that other place.
World, I'm going to tell you that this is one great PD. I recently needed a bit of advice for one of my own, and Dr. Bice went out of his way to help with that dilemma. And if that's any window into the kind of PD that's going to be helping you out for your 3 years there, I absolutely encourage you to take a very strong look at his program. And then, Madonna, tell me something that I don't know about Harbor UCLA.
Well, I had to unmute myself there. So I don't know what you do know about Harbor UCLA, but one of the, I think, unique aspects of our program is that our hospital has a hospital emergency response team that the residents get to train with. And so we get to do these training missions with the paramedics. They'll often take us on helicopters to their pseudo-collapsed buildings and freeways and get to lower into wells and do field rescues simulations with the paramedics. And that's a fun aspect of the program.
I think of your residents is really being like in the thick of it 24/7. That's a great place to train. Great faculty to teach you how to deal with all the interesting, crazy stuff that comes into Harbor. I remember fondly my interview there years ago. So all three great programs, great places to check out. Dr. Lynn, any final comments?
No, I just want to have you look at my banner right here. I'm just saying I'm totally unbiased. But beyond UCSF, Harbor is near and dear to my heart as well, having graduated from there. So I do encourage you to go check them out if you don't want to come to San Francisco.
All right. Thank you, panelists. Thanks to the viewers for putting up with a little technical difficulty. I hope you got something out of our talk today. Look for some more installments of our web series. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Emergency Medicine Match Advice. You can view any of our episodes for free on Allium's YouTube channel, or if you prefer, listen to the episodes as Allium podcasts on SoundCloud. Also, check out summaries of our episodes as blog posts on Allium.com and in the publication A User's Guide to the Allium EM Match Advice Series in the June 2017 issue of the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. We love to hear from our listeners. Post your questions or comments for any of our episodes on Allium.com. Thanks for joining us.